we're going to do is we're going to review the phylacteries, the exodus from Egypt, and of course the aftermath in Egypt and entering the Holy Land, and what are the borders of Israel. And then we're going to come up to a geopolitical military update today on the Middle East, which is really the reason I think you came here tonight. But I thought it was very important to lay the biblical justifications for what the United States and Israel and the West are going to have to do. Okay. You know, I am almost 60 years old. And I always say my wife hasn't divorced me, and she hasn't killed me yet. As you know, Billy Graham used to say that his wife would never divorce him, but she did believe in martyrology. My wife, too. 60 years of my life have been very, very interesting because I did not come from a religious Jewish home. I learned about these phylacteries for my bar mitzvah. I didn't really use them until about age 40. Like I said, then I went to seminary. I went to seminary at age 42, from age 42 to 44, and I really knew very little about Judaism. And of course, I knew nothing about Christianity. And when I went to seminary in 1991, one of the very, very first teachings that we received at the Jewish Theological Seminary was five verses from the New Testament. The very first verse of the New Testament that I ever read was Matthew 23, verse 5. Matthew 23, verse 5, "But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments." Now, the reason we were taught this at the Jewish Theological Seminary was because Matthew was written sometime between 50 and 70 AD. Now, of course, the Gospel, or the New Testament, is considered by many to be a Jewish book, but it is not considered within the rabbinic canon. It is a Christian book, Jewish-Christian, but it is outside of the canon. And because we're talking about a chronological fingerprint going back to the year 50 AD, what does this prove? This verse proves that Jews were using phylacteries and prayer shawls 2,000 years ago. Now, here I have the prayer shawl, a sample of the prayer. There are many different types of prayer shawls. This one, by the way, has the words in Hebrew for the blessing. And Jewish men wear this every day. Some Jewish men actually wear a T-shirt called the little talit, and it's within the shirt. And so sometimes you see the fringes hanging outside. When you see an Orthodox Jewish man, you see fringes hanging out. And it's because the fringes are part of the T-shirt itself. And that's called a talit katan, which is inside. Now, I'm not going to do it today, but in my 10-hour teaching, the very first DVD of the five teaches how Jesus healed the woman with the issue of blood. How many people remember the story about the woman who was bleeding for 12 years? This is a case of endometriosis, a situation in which a woman bleeds uncontrollably, above and beyond her monthly bleeding. And, of course, she is ritually unclean. According to Leviticus 15:19, no man can touch her, no woman can touch her, no child or parent can touch her. A woman who has endometriosis, according to the book of Leviticus 15:19, may not be touched by any other human being. She's like a leper. You cannot sit on her bed. You cannot sit on the same chair. You cannot touch her. If she touches you, you get the cooties. Remember the cooties? And Jesus is walking down one of the narrow alleyways of the old city, surrounded by his 12 disciples. And what does it say in Luke 8, 43 to 44? That this woman comes up from behind him, not in front of him, from behind him. You see, the prayer shawl has four fringes on each corner. The front fringe, as you can see, is like a yard in front of me. But if somebody is behind me and you pull on the back one, it's about 2 yards back. And Israel is a very, very windy place, so probably he was walking down the street and the fringes were flapping in the air. And this woman nicked the edge of the fringe of Jesus' prayer shawl, and she was healed for her faith. And of course, Jesus said, "Who touched me?" Because he felt somebody had taken away his virtue. The word is also power, but the word is not really power. The word is virtue, because once he's been given the cooties by this woman, he's made unclean. He can't. If another person gets touched by a woman and her bleeding, he cannot touch anyone, because then he passes on the cooties to the next person. See, the cooties, this comes from Leviticus 15:19. But Jesus says to her, "Go in peace, thy faith hath made thee whole." You all know the story, right? So it's the prayer shawl. Now, you all know the story about the young lady who was given up for dead and Jesus revived her. And the magical word was talita kumi. Talit is the prayer shawl, kumi is get up. So probably Jesus is saying, by the power in the prayer shawl, or in the tzitzit, which is very important for Jewish people, get up. So Jewish men wear this every day of the week, every day of the year. Now, Jewish men also have another piece of paraphernalia called the phylacteries. These are phylacteries, and we're going to go through them. But again, this is mentioned in Matthew 23, verse 5. And by the way, we had a general in the Israeli army who was also an archaeologist by the name of Yigal Yadin. I don't know how many of you have heard of Yigal Yadin, but Yigal Yadin excavated at Masada, which is a fortress that refused to surrender to the Romans, and the men committed suicide, and the women and the children, rather than surrender and be sold into slavery. And Yigal Yadin found samples of this in Masada. This is the headpiece, and it fits on like this. Now, we put this on 6 days of the week, but not Sabbath. The reason is because when you'll see in scripture, it says this, that the phylacteries will be a sign. Now, 6 days of the week, you need a sign. On the Shabbat, on Sabbath, you don't need a sign because the Sabbath is the sign. So that's why the rabbis do not have us put on the phylacteries. This is the head phylactery. This is the arm phylactery. And by the way, if you look at the bottom, this is all made of cowhide. And this is, you know, it's all cowhide, but it's moistened, and it's put on a mold, and then it's pushed down, and then it's dried, and then it's sanded down and painted with black. And this is the arm piece. So it'll be for frontlets between thy eyes, and for a sign upon thy arm. And when I was in seminary, they were telling us that not only does the New Testament talk about this, and that Jesus actually did put on phylacteries and prayer shawl. In other words, what I'm doing is something that Jesus did. And so what we do here is we write God's name on the hand. And one of God's names is Shaddai. Shaddai. Shad in Hebrew means the breast. Shaddai is the plural, many breasts. And by the way, it's a pagan, originally a pagan thing. There was a pagan goddess called Shaddai, which was a woman with many breasts, because the breast provides all the needs of a baby. And so God provides all our needs. So it says Shin, this is the Shin, this is the Dalet, and this is the Yud. El Shaddai means the God who provides all our needs. By the way, you know the joke about Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump dies and goes to heaven, and St. Peter says to him, "You know, Forrest, you're going to heaven, you're a good man, but first you have to answer three questions. First question, what are the 2 days of the week that start with the letter T? The second question, how many seconds are there in a year? And the third question, what is God's first name?" So Forrest Gump says, the 2 days of the week that start with the letter T are today and tomorrow. So St. Peter says, no, that's not the answer. But you're a good man, you're going to heaven. Just give me the other two answers and I'll let you in. How many seconds are there in a year? So Forrest Gump says there are 12 seconds in a year. The 12 seconds. Yeah, January 2nd, February 2nd, March the 2nd. So St. Peter says, that's not the answer. But you know what? You're a good man, you're going to heaven. Just give me the third answer. What is God's first name? He says that God's first name is Andy. Andy, where did you get Andy from? Andy walks with me, Andy talks with me. So anyway, this has God's name, El Shaddai. So Jewish men pray 6 days a week with this on their hand and the forehead, and we're all wrapped up. And when I was in seminary, I mean, I never knew why we're doing this thing. This is a crazy thing. Wrap yourself up with a leather strap and put this box here, and who knows what's inside it and everything. I mean, I was 42. I didn't even know what it was all about. I had to go to seminary to find these things out. And when they gave us Matthew 23, verse 5, they said, well, we know for sure that this goes back 2,000 years. But our rabbi said to us in seminary, but Jews have been using the prayer shawl and the phylacteries 3,500 years, all the way back to Mount Sinai. So the rabbis know that we go back to Mount Sinai with all this paraphernalia. So it's a dangerous thing to think. And so I started thinking, where did this start? Where does this come from? Okay, now you forgive me, it's hot with the lights. I'm taking the prayer shawl off because we don't need it now for this specific teaching that I'm doing. I'm going to take off the phylacteries also. At least the hand phylactery. I'm going to leave this on for a while. So this was in 1991. The first time I read anything from the New Testament. I was 42 years old. The very first verse of the New Testament that I ever read in Jewish Theological Seminary. 1992, I decided to study Greek at Hebrew University. I was studying modern Greek in the Greek club in Jerusalem. I was studying classical Greek at Hebrew University. I was studying Greek philosophy. I was studying New Testament all of a sudden for the first time, because those verses in seminary whetted my appetite to read and devour the New Testament. And so I was reading Greek, I was reading New Testament, and also the Jews have six chapters of philosophy known as Ethics of the Fathers. And this is part of the Saturday afternoon liturgy in the prayer book. And all of a sudden, I noticed that there are very, very clear parallels between Jewish philosophy, Greek philosophy, and New Testament. So anyway, 1992, a year later, I'm on a plane flying to New York from Tel Aviv. And who do I see on the plane? It was a Saturday night, Saturday morning. The president of my synagogue was with me in synagogue, and neither of us knew that either of us would be on the plane that night. And so when we met on the plane, we started talking about seminary, because he was president of the synagogue and I was in seminary, and I had ambitions, I had delusions of grandeur that I'd be a rabbi one day. By the way, instead of having a pulpit with 100 or 200 families, I am an unordained teacher to millions of Christians, thanks to Chuck Missler and Zola Levitt and a few other very good ministries, even if they are Southern Baptist. Anyway... So I'm talking to Arnie on the plane, and all of a sudden, a guy about that big gets up. He's a Greek Orthodox priest dressed in civilian. He says, I've been listening to you for the last 15 minutes. By the way, when I talk, even if you don't want to hear me, you're going to listen. And he grabbed me by the shirt. You're going to sit with me, and we're going to talk. So for 6 hours, I sat with this Greek Orthodox Christian priest, and... It was the six happiest hours on a plane I ever spent. We were sharing Jewish and Greek liturgies. And there's such striking similarities between the Greek Orthodox Church and the Jewish liturgy. And then I showed him the phylacteries. And he said to me, you know, we Greek Orthodox priests, we put on phylacteries too. I said to him, why do you put on phylacteries? That's a Jewish thing. He said, because Jesus Christ put on phylacteries. So we Greek Orthodox priests in the Greek Orthodox Church, we put on phylacteries too. So, and I've met with a number of Greeks, and they all know about it. It's not very common knowledge that Greek Christian priests put on phylacteries. Anyway, that was 1992. Let's fast forward to about a year ago. I don't know if I told you this. How many people, did I talk about this when I was here? I see a few people remember this. I'm walking down the street in Jerusalem, near my house. And some people come out of their house, they're from my synagogue, and say, Avi, we need you. We need a quorum of 10 men because somebody died, and they have to recite a certain prayer which requires a quorum of 10 men. Could you please join us? I said, sure. I went in to join them. And, Jewish people, Orthodox Jews, pray three times a day, once in the morning and twice in the afternoon, once just before sunset and once just after sunset. And usually there is a half-hour Talmud study session between the second and third services. So I sat with them. My wife was at work. And, you know, when I'm home, people say, what do you do in Israel? I say, I rest. And believe me, I need to. And so anyway, so in a house of mourning, when somebody dies, one of the main preoccupations of a Jewish family is the, defilement caused by contact with a dead corpse. In other words, when somebody dies in your family, you have to go and purify yourself in the temple with a special concoction of water made by the high priest with the ashes of the red heifer and hyssop and a few other ingredients. And of course, this secret disappeared when the temple was destroyed. And so we are all considered defiled today. But the Jewish people do have something called the baptism, which of course the Christians got from the Jews. The baptism in Hebrew is called the mikvah. And so a mikvah is a very critical thing for people who are coming out of their mourning period. And so the master of the house was telling us about trips that he made, showing us pictures. He went to Spain. And you know, the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. And there were many, many mikvahs, the Jewish communities buried in soil, and are just now being rediscovered so that the Catholics would not contaminate these ritual baths. And so he said, I was in Jordan in a place called Madaba. Has anyone ever heard of Madaba? Now, Madaba is a little town in the desert in Jordan, which evidently had a Jewish population there at some time because there was a mikvah. They found a mikvah there. And he said that he went into this building. He didn't know that it was a church, a Greek church. And he sees this picture, the picture that you see in front of you. He sees a picture on the wall. And he says, and can you believe it? He says, I was in Jordan. There are no Jews living in Jordan today. And yet there was a picture of a Jew wearing the phylacteries. You see here the man with the halo around his head. And he has one of these things sticking out on his head, of his head. You see it? That's the phylacteries. And I, after having read the New Testament and after having met this Greek Orthodox priest on the plane, I said to him, you know, I'd like to see this picture. Could you show it to me? And so he brought me the picture, and lo and behold, I knew exactly what it was. And I, you know, and I'm here in the presence of 10 Orthodox Jewish men. And I said, do you know what this picture is? He said, well, it's a Jew wearing phylacteries. So I said to him, well, you know, and again, you'll forgive me for being a little melodramatic, but I said, you know, the little child, I said, you know who the little child is? He said, no, that's Jesus. When I said Jesus, all of a sudden their heads went down like this, like they're going to die. Because you don't mention Jesus in a Jewish home. It's almost like considered like a curse. You can't understand how a Jew recoils when he hears the name Jesus. You have to remember, it's 2,000 years of Catholic and Russian Orthodox persecution and slaughter of the Jews. And the experience of Jewish people with the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants of the West is very limited. Okay. And then I said to him, and you have to understand something. When I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary, and their heads went down again, because mentioning the Jewish Theological Seminary to Orthodox Jews, you know, they don't like conservative Jews. It's like Catholics don't like Baptists, okay? Or if you can imagine all the Christian denominations that hate other Christian denominations, that's how the people felt towards the Jewish Theological Seminary. And of course, one of the reasons I was thrown out of seminary was because I opposed homosexual ordination. And of course, that I said that this reminded me of the Kaaba in Mecca. Because I got a wild imagination. And then I said to them, in the New Testament, when you say NT, New Testament, their heads go down also like this. These people were all being smitten, and then they were being brought out of their death. I said, Matthew 23, verse 5, which I just showed you, and their heads went down again. And it says that Jesus is, every time I say Jesus, New Testament, it's like they're dying. And I said, you know, the phylacteries are in use by Greek Orthodox priests. Now, this is not a Greek Orthodox priest. That's Jesus probably when he was 12. How many people remember Jesus was 12 when he was taken to the temple in Jerusalem? Okay. So if that's Jesus, then who are the man and woman behind him? Mary and Joseph. I mean, you got halos around their heads. If they're halos, that signifies something. And the rabbi with the halo around his head blessing Jesus is probably Gamaliel or one of the rabbis there wearing the phylacteries from 2,000 years ago. Does it make sense? What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look at the history. I'm trying to look at the chronology to see, does this make sense? By the way, I'm still on very good terms with these people. I don't live in that neighborhood anymore, but I'm always welcome in that synagogue. By the way, when I said to them that there were halos These Jews from New York and from Israel did not know what halos were. In other words, they don't know Christian art. And they didn't realize this was from a Greek Orthodox church in Jordan. This is not even from Israel, and it's not even something to do with the Jews. This is from the roots of Christianity. Okay. So, I'm in seminary, and they're teaching us. They open up, these are our sutures. You can see the sutures here. If you cut the sutures open, this opens up. Or if you go to a phylactery factory, you'll... Did I say something? I didn't say a bagel factory. I said a phylactery factory. So this opens up, and you'll see revealed inside four pouches. Inside of the four pouches are four parchments. Okay? I mean, this is not just something to look at. There's something inside of it. It means something. The four pouches have four parchments. The four parchments, two of them are from Exodus 13. One is from Deuteronomy 6 and Deuteronomy 11. We're going to go through the what's in here. Now, if I were a Christian phylactery factory, I'd have five pouches. Because I got to put in Matthew 23, verse 5 also. But a Jewish phylactery has four pouches. Okay. Now, let's go to the description of the phylacteries. Well, first, let's go back to where we left off before the break. You remember I was saying that God says to Moses, tell Pharaoh, let my people go that they may celebrate me in the desert, celebrate the Lord in the desert. Then, again, the word celebrate also means to go around in circles, which I said is the Hajj. You remember that? You know, the seven times around the Kaaba. Okay, now let's think for a moment. Moses is 40 years in Egypt. Then he's 40 years in the desert with Jethro. What do we know about Egypt? Egypt and Pharaoh. Pharaoh is God, number one. Number two, Pharaoh has a whole pantheon of gods, pagan gods, animals, bugs, the sun, all kinds of pagan gods in the pantheon of Pharaoh. And by the way, one of the gods is the golden calf. Remember after the Ten Commandments, Moses tarries. Moses is 40 days up there in the mountain, and the children of Israel despair, and they build a golden calf. It wasn't because they were sinners. It was because they wanted to go back to the God of Egypt, or the gods of Egypt. Because human beings cannot live in a vacuum. Human beings must have a God or God in them, some kind of spirituality. You can't leave. People are not animals. People have to have a spirituality. So you have a religious system in Pharaoh, a religious system in his pantheon of gods. And then across the river, excuse the expression, across the Red Sea, in Midian, this is of course according to my teaching, you've got the black stone. And again, there is no Muslim, there is no Muhammad, there is no Allah. The black stone is a pre-Judaism, pre-Christianity, pre-Islam faith, according to the Druze, of a universalistic God. And Jethro is the high priest. And Moses, 40 years, is an understudy to Jethro. And all of a sudden, Moses sees the burning bush, and God says, go back to Pharaoh at age 80 and tell him, let my people go. And so Moses says to God, under what authority? Who am I going to say sent me? And so God says, the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, again, this is my postulating here. No rabbi, no Jew in the world has said this yet. Abraham is with Jethro 40 years. I believe that the black stone at that time may have had some pagan traits to it. But the 12 tribes that were living as slaves in Egypt, what God were they following? They were not following the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were following the pagan gods of Pharaoh. Are you with me? We went down into Egypt as a family. We didn't go down as a nation. We came out as a nation. But Judaism as a religion only begins where? With the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. We're not there yet. We are still pagan shepherd slaves in Egypt. Are you with me? And we're slaves and we're being hounded and we're being beaten and we're being killed by the pharaohs. And God hears our cries. And God says to Moses, go out and get your people out of there. I mean, Moses says, who are you and who is this God and who is the God of Pharaoh? And, you know, even Moses doesn't really know what's going on here. And so you have, forgive me, I mean, this is Avi Lipkin speaking. I don't know if it's God. I think it's God. But you've got two systems. By the way, there's no Hinduism. There's no Buddhism. These came later. There's no Judaism. There's no Christianity. There's no Islam. What you have is you have the black stone in Mecca, and you have Pharaoh's God system, God with a small g. And that God system of Pharaoh is enslaving the Jews. And so Moses has to go to Egypt and convince the Israelites that they're not going to be slaves anymore, that they're going to go into the desert and they're going to be free people. And so the children of Israel are going to say, what God are you talking about? No, because people, primitive people, they have to feel the God. They have to have silver, gold, wooden idols. Again, you can't judge the slaves coming out of Egypt as you would judge people today in the Judeo-Christian 21st century. Are you with me? You understand what I'm saying? This is a very revolutionary idea. So I ask that you have patience with this. So Moses goes to the elders. He goes to the children of Israel. He goes to Pharaoh. And he says the God of Israel is requiring the release of the children of Israel, that they should leave the slavery and the pagan gods of Pharaoh. What does our God say to Pharaoh? I will destroy your gods. Isn't that what God says? I will wreak havoc on the gods of Egypt. So the children of Israel cannot leave Egypt in a spiritual vacuum. The children of Israel must be given a replacement God, not the gods of Pharaoh. And Moses said, this is Exodus 8, 26, and Moses said, it is not, this must be a typo, it is not to do, right to do, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God. Lo, shall we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, and will they not stone us? In other words, we said to Pharaoh, let us go, let our people go, so that they may serve the Lord in the desert, so that it would not be an abomination to the Christians. It was a replacement theology. It was a different theological system. Okay, let's get into the heavy stuff now. What's inside of the phylacteries? You've got four parchments. Two of them are Exodus 13. And if you look here, it says, and it shall be for a sign on thy hand, which is what I wore before, and for a memorial between thine eyes. This thing is between our eyes. You know what this is showing us? This is showing us the direction we're going to. I believe it was the direction of the Kaaba, because that was where I think Jethro was. That the Lord's law may be in thy mouth. By the way, law we never had before. For with a strong hand hath the Lord brought thee out of Egypt. Thou shalt therefore keep this ordinance for in his season from year to year, that we're talking about the Passover. And it shall be when the Lord shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore unto thee and to thy fathers, and shall give it to thee, that thou shalt set apart unto the Lord all that openeth the matrix and every firstling that cometh of a beast. In other words, sacrificing the firstborn animal which thou hast, the male shall be the Lord's. And every firstling and ass thou shalt redeem with a lamb, and if thou wilt not redeem it, then thou shalt break his neck. And all the firstborn of man among thy children shalt thou redeem. In other words, we shall replace our children with an animal sacrifice. And it shall be when thy son asketh thee in time to come, saying, what is this? Thou shalt say unto him, by the strength of the hand of the Lord brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that the Lord slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all that openeth the matrix, being males. But all the firstborn of my children shall I redeem. And it shall be a token for thy hand and for frontlets between thine eyes. These are the two first pouches inside of the phylacteries. For by strength of the hand of the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, and they return to Egypt. So if we're not going through the land of the Philistines, and if Sinai was an Egyptian bastion, where were we going? To Arabia. It was the only possible place. And I think you all know enough about Arabia to know that there is nothing at all in Arabia other than oil and that black stone. Okay. So, four pouches, four parchments. The first two we read are from Exodus 13. By the way, what do we know about Exodus 13? Exodus 13, remember the matzah bread that the Jews eat on Passover? Because it was we didn't have time to let it rise. The dough didn't rise. It was on our backs as we were leaving slavery. Immediately after that, we're fleeing from Egypt, and this is where we get these phylacteries. This is a guiding, how shall I say, what do you call it? Not a compass, a gyroscope. It's a GPS. It's directing us where we have to go. Okay, here comes the third parchment, which is inside of every phylactery. And I think, as Christians, you all know where this comes from also. Hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, the Lord our God is one Lord, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God, where did you hear that from? With all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thy heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Okay, and thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be for frontlets between thine eyes. So when Jesus says that the most important commandment of all is, Hear, O Israel, love the Lord thy God, that's the same thing as here. It's in Mark 12, 28 to 31. By the way, the first verse of the New Testament I ever read was Matthew 23, verse 5 about the phylacteries. And the next four verses I learned about of the New Testament were Mark 12, 28 to 31. Okay, let's look at Mark 12. Here it is. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked Jesus, which is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and all thy strength. This is the first commandment. So Jesus is repeating what is the most important commandment for every Christian, and repeating the most important commandment for every Jew. The number one commandment for the Jew and the Christian is the same commandment. And the second is like, namely this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And here it is also, Leviticus 19:18. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. By the way, I once heard this. I always hear this from the Southern Baptists. They say, and Jesus Christ is not a Christian, Mary is not a Catholic, and John is definitely not a Baptist. Okay. The fourth parchment in the phylacteries is from Deuteronomy 11, 13 to 18. And it shall come to pass, if ye shall hearken diligently unto my commandments, which I command you this day. By the way, not the commandments that I commanded you before, because there were no commandments before. These are new commandments. To love the Lord your God, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. That I will give you the rain of your land in his due season. The first rain and the latter rain. The first rain is in the spring, the latter rain is in the fall. That thou mayest gather in thy corn, thy wine, and thy oil. And I will send grass in thy fields for thy cattle, that thou mayest eat and be full. Take heed to yourselves, that your heart be not deceived, and ye turn aside and serve other gods, and worship them. And then the Lord's wrath be kindled against you, and he shut up the heaven, that there be no rain, and that the land yield not her fruit, and lest ye perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord hath given you. Therefore shall ye lay up these words in your heart and in your soul, and bind them for a sign upon your hand, that they may be as frontlets between thine eyes. Now do you know what's inside of the phylacteries? Okay. So, I get into trouble, because I'm in seminary, and I say, if this goes back 3,500 years, and boy, they sure look like the Kaaba, and maybe Jethro was the high priest of the Kaaba. Because I can't find any other place in Arabia that matches the description. Now I want to share something else with you. What I'm trying to do here is to show some of the systems that were prevalent when the children of Israel left Egypt, some of these very primitive pagan societies. Like I said before, that they would offer their children on the altar of Molech. sleeping with animals, which is known as bestiality, homosexuality, which is one of the reasons why Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. But there were also other reasons that God's anger was kindled against the children of Israel. One of them was whoredom, in other words, temple prostitution. And what happened was the Jewish people, who were commanded basically to wipe out these people, decided to live in peace with them. And so our children started intermarrying with the sons and daughters of Moab. As you all know, Moab is just across from the Holy Land, across the Arava, and in northwestern Saudi today. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods. And the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined itself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Again, we are talking about a number of things which are even remembered in the New Testament, or called about in the New Testament. You have Acts 15 and Acts 21, where it says, if we are not under the law as the Hebrews are, what are some of the things we should avoid? And of course, one of them is don't eat meat offered to the idols, which is what was going on here, and also temple prostitution. The oracle at Delphi, for example, in Greece, was a prostitute. The Canaanites, the Romans, the Greeks, all these systems had something called temple prostitution. You'd go to these temples, you'd pay the prostitute, you'd have sex, and boy, what a wonderful religion, isn't it? So God did not like this. Baal Peor, for example, was a religion in which people would defecate underneath a tree, and the tree was their god. And all of these things caused anger of the Lord against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people, hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one of his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses. So Ken, what do we have with the Midianites? We are with Midian. We are there living with them. And in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who are weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when Pinchas, or in English Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. In other words, the man and the woman were committing sex in the name of the God of Moab, in front of the very eyes of Moses and the children of Israel. And so Pinchas, Phinehas, put an end to it by basically skewering them. So the plague was stayed, the plague was stopped for the children of Israel, and those that died in the plague were 24,000. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Wherefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel. Now, you know, one of the things I want to share before I continue with this is that many Muslims say, well, you know, the Hebrew Bible is full of killing also. You know, that God commands the children of Israel to wipe out seven Canaanite nations. Well, anyway, the first thing I want to say is we never wiped out the seven Canaanite nations. When you go to Chronicles, the book of Chronicles, King David is talking about all these pagan nations are still there. So we never wiped them out. That's number one. We were commanded to. We did not do what God told us to do, and we paid for it with all the exiles and all the terrible things we went through. So firstly, we did not wipe them out. Secondly, why were we supposed to wipe out the seven Canaanite nations? Because of the whoredom, because of the homosexuality, because of the bestiality, because of the sacrifice of the little children, because of all the crazy things that they were doing. And the land would vomit them out. That's what God said. And he said, if Israel would behave in the same manner as these pagan nations, the land would vomit out the Jews too. And that's exactly what happened twice. So let's continue. Numbers 25. Now the name of the Israelite woman, the Israelite that was slain, even that was slain was with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, a prince of a chief house among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman that was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Tzur. He was head over a people and of a chief house in Midian. Again, we're talking about Medina. We're talking about the desert. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, vex the Midianites, and smite them, for they vex you with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the manner of Peor, again, the defecation at the tree, and in the matter of Cozbi, the sex, the daughter of Prince of Midian, their sister, which was slain in the day of the plague for Peor's sake. And it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saying, okay, well, basically you got the gist of what was going on there. Oh, I remember what it was. If you look at the last three lines, it says, and it came to pass after the plague. Okay, you see that? Now, and what it has happened in English here is that there is a continuation, and it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spoke unto Moses. Okay, now, when you look at the Hebrew, there's something very wrong here. In the Hebrew, you have three words. Here it's more than three words, but in Hebrew, and it came to pass after the plague, and then there's an empty space. It means it was censored. It was censored or it was erased. When it says, the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saying, that's a completely different sentence. So something is very disjointed in the text in Hebrew. So that's something I just wanted to share with you. We studied that in seminary. Okay, Exodus 18, we're going to jump over to Exodus. We're still in Exodus. And they judged the people at all seasons. In other words, Moses, at the behest of Jethro, establishes judges. The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. The judges judged in the name of Moses. And then it says, and Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way into his own land. In other words, what's going on here? What's the whole story? The whole story is very simple. The children of Israel are leaving slavery in Egypt. They're leaving a pagan pantheon of Pharaoh. They are kind of, excuse the expression, misled by God to go to the Kaaba in Mecca. On the way to the Kaaba, we are diverted to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb. At Mount Sinai, what happens? We get the Ten Commandments. And then all of a sudden, we get this whole list of commandments, a whole new religion. Judaism is formed at Mount Sinai, and then instead of making a right turn, we make a left turn. In other words, we go up to the land of milk and honey, and Jethro goes back to Midian. But one of the things I see here, which I think is of great interest, does anyone know where Jethro is buried? Is he buried in Mecca? Is he buried in Medina? Does anyone know? He's buried in Tiberias at the Horns of Chitin. Did anyone ever hear of the Horns of Chitin? That was the battle in which Richard the Lionhearted was defeated by Saladin. The Druze who worship Jethro go to his tomb, which is in Tiberias. Now, why would Jethro not be buried in Saudi Arabia? And, I try to read the Bible between the lines. Who is Jethro? Jethro was the father-in-law of Moses. So if Moses and the people of Israel wiped out the Midianites, I don't think that Jethro could really stay there very much longer. Jethro had to flee together with the Israelites. So on the one hand, it says here he went back to his land. But the fact is, I don't think he stayed there. I think he went, in the end, to the Holy Land, and he was buried. Because the Druze tradition is that Jethro is buried near Tiberias. Yeah, I mean, if your father-in-law, if somebody's going to wipe out your people, you better get out of there. Okay. I want to go back for a moment to my dear friends, the Caldwells in Mississippi. And what drives me crazy? I really don't know my own book very well. I don't know the Old Testament. And these Christians, they say, Elijah was in Mecca and Medina. So what? Yeah. Look at 1 Kings chapter 18 and chapter 19. Now, I didn't put down chapter 18 here, but how many people remember the story about the 450 priests of Baal? And Elijah shows off against these 450 priests of Baal, and he wins. God chooses the offering of Elijah, and he rejects the offering of the 450 priests of Baal. By the way, it's a very interesting thing in the story there, if you remember. Elijah says to the 450 priests of Baal, you guys go first, I go last. And the 450 priests of Baal are dancing and singing and admonishing that their God should come and take their offering, and nothing happens. And so Elijah says, perhaps your gods are busy. They don't hear you. Perhaps they're taking a pee or something. That's what Elijah said to them. And so the 450 priests of Baal, what do? They start taking knives and staves and start cutting themselves and bleeding, gashing themselves. Where do we see this? In Lebanon with the Shiites, the Ashura. You know where they cut themselves and they're bleeding? This, again, is one of the pagan attributes of Islam, of the Shiites. And then, of course, Elijah welcomes God, take the offering. You know, Elijah pours water on it. You know why Elijah poured all the water on that meat? That was for the gravy. So, of course, God took up the meat, he took up the water, he took up the stones, he took up everything, he took up the dust. There was nothing left. Okay. Then Jezebel, decides, and she's killed all the other prophets. She's got to get rid of Elijah. This is Elijah's a pain, you know. And so Elijah flees from Mount Carmel. That's chapter 19 in 1 Kings. So you have to look at 18 and 19 together. Chapter 19, he flees to Beersheba. He says, and when he saw that, he arose and fled for his life and came to Beersheba. Now, where's Beersheba? It's in the south of Israel, in the Negev, which belongeth to Judah. He left his servant there. And then he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life. For I am not better than my fathers. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said unto him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake, bacon on the coals, and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he rose and he did eat and drink and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the mount of God. And he came thither unto a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said unto him, what dost thou here, Elijah? Okay, now, if you remember at the very beginning, you have this map of Arabia. 40 days and 40 nights, brothers and sisters, is not Santa Catarina Sinai, because you can do that in about 3-4 days. 40 days and 40 nights is going through that Saudi desert and through the mountains of northwestern Saudi Arabia. Mount Horeb. And the cold wells were there. And the cold wells took pictures of the cave. And the cold wells took pictures of the stone. Remember, Moses smote the stone and it split in half and water came out gushing in the middle of the desert? They took pictures of that. In the middle of the desert, there are signs of a river coming out of a tremendous boulder. Okay. Now, why am I doing this? Why am I teaching this? Why? I don't want to say I'm losing sleep, because God gives me a very good sleep every night, but why is this on my mind all the time? I mean, these Caldwell people in Mississippi and, you know, Bob Cornuke and Tim Mahoney and Pete Windall. And by the way, how many people heard of Michael Medved? By the way, I'm going to be on the show, God willing, Friday at 1 p.m. Michael Medved also supports this theory that the Israelites went to Arabia. We have to find a way to make the rabbis open their eyes and accept the GPS system that God is giving us today. Now, I've been with Koinonia House. I'm honored. I praise God that John Leffler and Chuck Missler started working, allowing me to work with them since 1995. I've done 6 teachings here at Koinonia House. This is the 7th, God willing. And the emphasis has been the Islamic threat. And I think you'll all agree with me, it seems like Islam is winning. You know, in Revelation 17, you have the harlot riding the dragon. And forgive me for interpreting it, but in my opinion, the dragon is Islam, serpent is the devil, is Islam, is Allah. And the harlot is the world economic system, paid for services rendered. And so Islam has a harlot. The harlot is anyone who's ready to be paid for services rendered, which are not the call of God. And so the Muslims are selling you the oil at outrageous prices. The very economy of the world is threatened. A gentleman, a Marine, ex-Marine, called me the last few days 10 times. He said, you're going to Chuck Missler, you're going to Koinonia House, and tell the people the Saudis have a plan to buy up real estate. You know, there's so many foreclosures on the mortgage market, and the Muslims are counting their blessings. Because the Muslims are buying up all these houses for next to nothing. And they're throwing all their money behind a certain number, few number of major banks. So they take over those banks and then bankrupt all the other banks. So that the whole United States will belong to Islam. And they're using your money to do it. And they're doing it in Europe. And they're doing it all over the world. And Islam is getting strengthened on all fronts. Now, of course, you know the back of the book. And you know who has the victory. And I think I know who has the victory, and I'm with you. And God says certain things in the Bible, because you know you have the Alpha and you have the Omega in the Bible. You have things that people who do not know the Bible will be desperate and will be depressed and may commit suicide, but people who have faith are strengthened. Deuteronomy 11, 23 to 25. Then will the Lord drive out all these nations from before you, and you shall possess greater nations and mightier than yourselves. Every place whereon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. From the wilderness, okay, now see, wilderness, you know, wilderness could be Coeur d'Alene, you know, it could be up in Bonner's Ferry there, you know. Wilderness, what's the wilderness is where there's nothing, where it's wild, okay? In Hebrew, it says midbar. Midbar is the desert. So God is describing our borders from the desert, and Hebrew says Midbar HaGadol, from the great desert, and Lebanon. In other words, from Lebanon to Saudi Arabia, from the river Euphrates, even unto the uttermost sea shall your coast be. There shall no man be able to stand before you, for the Lord your God shall lay fear of you and the dread of you upon all the land that ye shall tread upon, as he hath said unto you. Okay, twice. We see here, every place whereon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. You know what that is, that picture? The Caldwells took pictures of thousands of sandal prints in what was sand at that time and became petrified in the baking desert of Saudi Arabia. These are the sandals of the Israelites. And they took pictures, unbelievable amount of pictures. I don't have them here, but the movie shows pictures of menorahs. The menorahs are etched into the rocks everywhere. Now, you may not know where Medina, Mecca Medina are, or Midian. We as Jews maybe do not know. Maybe the rabbis don't want to know. But you know who knows? The Saudis know. The Bedouin know exactly in Saudi Arabia where the mountain of Moses is. That's why the Saudi army today has fenced it off. And the Saudis are very conscientiously destroying all of the archaeological signs that point to a Jewish presence there, an Israelite presence. Because God says in Deuteronomy, wherever your feet shall tread. Here's another picture of sandal marks. What does it say in Galatians? I mentioned this at the very beginning. Galatians 4:25, for this is Hagar. There's a little typo there. It's Hagar, is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. By the way, what does it say? What is the very first verse of the New Testament? Matthew 1, chapter 1, page 1, first words, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David. By the way, this is cut off a little. It says, son of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, who are you going to be with? Are you going to be with the Jews or are you going to be with the Muslims? You're going to be with the Jews because the God of the Jews is the God of the Christians. And if the Muslims are right, there goes the divinity of Jesus Christ. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying here. There's no compromise in this. I received an email from Penny Caldwell, and it was a press release by Osama bin Laden. And Osama bin Laden is saying, we have to kill all the Jews. We have to destroy Israel because otherwise they're going to come and claim what is theirs. Mecca and Medina is theirs. We know it. The only people who don't want to know that Mecca and Medina belongs to the Jews are the Jews. So God has a plan. And you know, I speak about this in my call for a political party. Today, God has brought home to Israel Christians who are married to the Jews from Russia, Ukraine, Ethiopia. Our population is no longer 2% Christian, it's 8% Christian. 2% Christian are Arab Christians who are being ethnically cleansed by their Muslim neighbors. But we have 6% of our population is immigrant Christian, married to the Jews. They serve in the army, they pay taxes, and they vote. Remember the Boston Tea Party? No taxation without representation. These Christians serve in the army. They're Zionists. What does it say in Genesis and in Numbers? I will bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. So if these Christians are married to Jews, are they blessing us or cursing us? They're blessing us. I'm not talking about the mothers-in-law. By the way, you know the famous Jewish joke. What's the difference between a Polish Jewish mother and a Doberman Pinscher? The Doberman Pinscher eventually lets go. So, 2% of our population is Arab Christian, and I speak Arabic. 6% of our population is immigrant Christian, mostly Russians. 6% of our population is Jewish, married to these 6%, which are Russian Christians. So the constituency that I believe will vote for the Bible Bloc Party, which I'm founding very soon, God willing, with your help also, is 14%. 14% in the Knesset means 15 members of Knesset out of 120. And I'm proud to announce in the last few months, since I was last here in November, that I've met with Catholic archbishops from the Vatican ambassadors. I know you don't really love the Catholics so much, but what can we do? Half of the Christians in Israel are Catholic. Half the Christians are Orthodox. You know, we just don't have you guys yet in Israel. That'll be changed one day. And the reason I say that is because if you know my messages from the past regarding the party and also regarding Islamic infiltration into America, the intermarriage rates in America vary between 50 to 70%, Jews and Christians. So if you have 5 million Jews in Israel and 500,000 Christians, which is what we have, outside of Israel, what we have is 8 million Jews and about 2 or 3 million Christians married to us. And when the Muslims come gunning to kill the Jews, when the Jew flees to Israel, the Jew will not leave the Christian spouse here, I believe. And the Jew and the Christian spouse will not leave their children here. So there's going to be a tsunami of immigration to Israel after the next war in the Middle East. When will the next war in the Middle East be? Anytime. Who knows when? And so I believe eventually that the Bible Bloc Party, if our population grows from 7 million to 15 to 20 million overnight, all these Western Christians and Jews who will be coming home will join my party, which means the Bible Bloc Party will be the biggest party in the Knesset. Forget about the Likud, forget about Labor, forget about Kadima, forget about Olmert. You'll be able to visit him in Maaseiahu prison. Now, I wanted to give an update. We have some time left. I've done some teachings here. One of them was about the war that's coming with Iran. And I wanted to give you some updates. How many people know that there are Israeli military jets in Iraq today? Two hands, three hands, four, five, six. That there are Israeli military attack aircraft in Iraq today. You know, the American bases in Iraq. Israeli planes are now flying practice runs back and forth between Israel and Iraq. How many people know that? Okay. How many people know that about a month and a half ago, Israel had a dry run with its planes to Greece, to Crete? Israel practiced mid-air refueling. Israel practiced the fetching of downed pilots. The Iranians are broadcasting that they know about this. My wife, by the way, checked this out with her sources. It's true. Since I was here last November in Coeur d'Alene, in December there was a conference at Annapolis in which the leaders of 48 nations came to Annapolis to talk peace between Israel and the Palestinians. As they say in American slang, come on, give me a break. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that there will never be peace with the Palestinians, and there will never be a Palestinian state. You, by the way, you know the joke I always tell about this. Reagan, Brezhnev, and Shamir in 1980 were summoned to God's office. God is ticked off with the world. He said the human race does nothing but evil all day, and he's going to destroy the human race in 2 weeks. Go back and prepare your people. In 2 weeks, the world's going to be destroyed. So Reagan comes back to the American people, and as a good politician, he says, okay, fellow Americans, I got good news and bad news. Good news is there is a God. I know. I spoke to him like Charlton Heston. The bad news, he's going to destroy the earth in 2 weeks. Get ready. Brezhnev gets up in front of the Russian people. He says, fellow Russians, I have two pieces of terrible news for Soviet peoples. Firstly, you remember we were communists. We were atheists. We didn't believe in God. Well, guess what? We were wrong. There is a God. I know. I spoke to him. He spoke to me, and we're all damned. And the second piece of terrible news, he's going to destroy the world in 2 weeks. Get ready. And Shamir, the Israeli leader, gets up in front of the Jewish people. He says, fellow Israelis, I have two pieces of wonderful news for the Jewish people. Firstly, I spoke to God. He exists. I spoke to him like Moshe Rabbeinu, like Moses. And the other piece of wonderful news, there never will be Palestinian state. So, I'm telling you by the highest authority that there won't be a Palestinian state. So the question is asked, why would 48 world leaders, are they so stupid? Why would 48 world leaders come to Annapolis to meet with Bush and to meet with Olmert and to meet with Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen? And all along, I felt that the reason was Iran. Now, let's go back a little bit. You Americans, I am also an American. I don't take credit for it, but some very smart people voted for the greatest president in American history, Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter decided to bring down the Shah of Iran. You know, Shah of Iran, of course, was America's number one ally in the Islamic world, cornerstone of Cold War policy against the Soviet Union. And but the problem with the Shah of Iran, he was a dictator. You know, because if you're ruling an Islamic country, there's no democracy. You got to be a dictator. If you're a dictator, you're guilty of human rights violations. And Jimmy Carter didn't like the Shah because of human rights violations. But Jimmy Carter did like Ayatollah Khomeini. Because Ayatollah Khomeini was a religious man. And Jimmy Carter was a religious man. And of course, don't we all serve the same God? So if you're a religious Muslim, it's the same as being a religious Christian. In other words, anyone who serves the devil is the same as somebody who serves God. That's what Jimmy Carter believed. And the first thing that happened when Khomeini came to power was that Iran went from being America's number one ally to being America's number one enemy. And they took the hostages at the U.S. Embassy for 444 days. And what's the motto of the throngs in the streets? Death to America, death to Israel. America and Israel have been preparing for this war with Iran since 1979. The F-15s, the F-16s, all these weapons that the U.S. and the Israeli militaries together have been developing have been for the war that is about to happen with Iran. And by the way, the war has nothing to do with nuclear weapons of Iran. That's just an excuse. And you know what? God forbid if the Iranians dropped an atom bomb on some city and killed 1 million people. That is not as bad as if the American economy collapses, which is what Iran wants. The Islamic world says that the greatness of the Christian West is its economy. To destroy the Christian West, and especially the great Satan America, you've got to destroy the economy of America, destroy the economy of the West. What happens when the American economy collapses? Not 1 million. Hundreds of millions of people will die from starvation because the U.S. and the world will be incapable of continuing to feed the poor people all over the world. Again, Islam is of the devil. And if the American economy goes down, the European economy goes down. And if the European economy goes down, the Chinese, the Indian, and the Japanese economies go. Everyone goes down. So the war with Iran is not about nuclear weapons. The war with Iran is about replacing a crazy, cancerous regime which is metastasizing and spreading its cancers into Iraq, into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, all over the world. I don't want to praise President Bush too much, but you know, everyone was saying after the invasion of Iraq, what a mess, and the oil is not coming forthwith. But you know that today that the oil production in Iraq is more than it was under Saddam Hussein. In other words, yes, it is about oil. And it may be that the Shiites or the Sunnis or the Kurds own that oil, but the point is the oil belongs to the world. The oil is the lifeblood, the oxygen of the world. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but the crazy Russians are kicking out all the foreign investors developing their oil, and so Russian oil production is dropping. And the Russians don't care, because the more their oil production drops, the more money they make on the little that they still have. The Iranians kicked out the Westerners, their oil production is dropping. But they don't care, because the little they have, they get more money. The Saudis, the Gulf states, Chavez, all of their oil production is collapsing because they're kicking out the Western oil companies. And they're laughing their heads off because they're driving the prices sky high. And these Americans and Europeans and Chinese and Indians and Japanese don't have a choice. Or so they think. Now, I know Chuck Missler, if he were here now, he'd be saying, oh, there's Avi the globalist. Because the solution for Iran is a globalist solution. The Iranian regime has to be replaced. After the Iranian regime is replaced, there'll be democracy and things will improve in Iran and things will improve in Iraq and in Afghanistan. You've got to remove these cancers one by one and replace them with democratic Western institutions. And it'll still take 3, 4, 5 years to rebuild the oil infrastructure of Iran. I have only a few minutes left, and I'm going to say something really crazy. You know, it says in the Bible that God blessed Ishmael, God blessed Esau, God blessed Jacob with the oil. We see the Islamic world does have the oil. Israel still has not gotten the oil. It will. I think many of you remember my testimony about the Dallas Council on World Affairs in Dallas in 1991. It's in my teachings. It's in my books. That the One World Government people in Dallas said to me, we will not let the Jews get in the way of our oil supplies, which is, of course, dangerous for Israel. But the same applies to the Muslims. Same applies to Iran. We will not let Iran or Saddam Hussein get in the way of our oil supplies. Because the whole world economy is dependent on that oil. And if the Muslims cannot defend the oil, and if they cannot preserve it and supply it regular, you know, steady oil prices, steady oil supplies, you know, in other words, not this radical $150, $200, $300 a barrel, which is what the Iranians want. Because that way they bankrupt the American economy. They bankrupt the world economy. And so, I will give you a short end of the story regarding Iran. I believe Israel will send its planes in day one. And it doesn't matter what Israel does. It doesn't matter if it takes out 90%, 50%, or even 10% of the nuclear project of Iran. Day one, the Israeli air attack. Day two, the Iranians shut the Straits of Hormuz. Within 2 weeks, the world economy collapses. Because no oil, no plastic. So day three, the United Nations is going to beg the United States to go in and finish the job. Now, you are overextended in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but your Air Force is not overextended. The United States has B-1s, B-2s, B-52s, cruise missiles, and all kinds of other little toys. And by the way, wars, forgive me for saying it like this, I'm not saying it from my heart, I'm saying it cynically. Wars are good for testing new toys. The Iranians will be given such a severe blow by the U.S. Air Force in 3 days, and the U.S. will say, do you surrender? And of course they'll say no. That's why they're preparing 300,000 graves in Iran. 200,000 Iraqis died in Desert Storm. 3 more days of bombing, there is no more Iranian military. And then the United Nations brings in a replacement regime, like in Afghanistan. And the Iranian people will be blessed. The Iranian people will be relieved. They'll have democracy, they'll have freedom, and their economy will begin to be revived. So Israel starts it, and President Bush retires from the White House, having terminated the axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. It's not about a Palestinian state. The 48 leaders came to discuss Iran. The Saudis want America to go into Iran. You know why? Because the Shiites of Iran want to slaughter the Saudis for selling the oil to the Americans in the first place. That we discussed in Shiite Sunni, the two houses of Islam. That's in the CD and DVD. So I have the confrontation with Iran, which is a military talk. Shiite Sunni houses, which is the next talk, which talks about them. The latest DVD I did was Turkey and the Armageddon, which is a more of a futuristic thing. But the bottom line I'm saying is that the day is going to come, and I've spoken about this before, that either that black stone in Mecca will be nuked, cutting off the head of the snake and terminating Islam, or, I've been changing my mind, it shouldn't be nuked, we should raise the Israeli flag over the Kaaba. And that will terminate Islam also. And then I will help the Christians to convert all of these Muslims to Christianity. And then there'll be peace on earth. Thank you very much.